Some things are college freshman essentials, like shower sandals, because otherwise, yuck. And of course, a Brita pitcher. Your teen could save over $240 a year by switching to Brita from bottled water. Plus, Brita Elite removes 99% of lead from tap water. Get your freshman a Brita pitcher with the Elite filter today. 99% of lead certified by WQA. Substances reduced may not be in all users' water. $240 savings a year versus standard 16.9 fluid ounce water bottles. Savings assumes pre-purchase of Brita system.
You're listening to a Hindustan Times podcast, brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hi, this is Manjula Narayan, National Books Editor, Hindustan Times, and this is the Books and Authors podcast. It's a weekly podcast where I speak to authors who've got a new book out. Today we have with us Arvind Sharma, who's written From Fire to Light, Rereading the Manusmriti. Hello, sir.
How do you do?
Fine. Okay, so you know, this is a really interesting book because, you know, first of all, everybody is very scared to touch the Manusmriti, you know. I mean, in contemporary India, you know, like you've touched upon in the book itself, you know, it's like, and your first line itself is very revelatory. You have said, how did you begin? You began to write on the Manusmriti is to play with fire. So literally it is like that. So I was quite surprised to see the book, first of all. And then when I read it, it's full of very insightful, you know, stuff. So let's talk about, you know, why you decided to write this to begin with.
Yeah, sure. See, I'm an Indologist, and the Manusmriti is frequently referred to in our discussions.
Yes.
And I've been in my field for a long time now. And so towards the virtual end of my career, I could see certain patterns, you know, in the way the book was cited.
Yes.
And so I tried to investigate what lay behind it. And it has become symbolic of what is wrong with Hinduism.
Yes.
In a way.
Yes.
So I thought it should be investigated with some care to see the extent to which what people say about it corresponds to what it actually says. And then I had this larger curiosity of why was this book written and when?
Yes.
So the context, the historical context of the book was a major issue with me. In the sense that if you can locate it in historical context, then you can understand the text better.
Yes. Yes. So, you know, let's talk about the historical context, because that's something nobody thinks about.
So what I noticed was, as a student of Indian history, that the Manusmriti comes or has been composed after a period of four major foreign invasions of India, especially North India. The Indo-Bactrians, the Indo-Parthians, the Shakas or the Scythians, and then the Kushanas or the Yechi. So I presume that these invasions have an important role to play in what it is saying. And then, probing further, one realized that these invasions took place towards the end of the Mauryan Empire, whose great figure, as we know, is Ashoka.
Yes.
Now, when I looked further into Ashoka, I found that there are three assessments of Ashoka. You can locate them in world history, in Indian history, and in Hindu history.
Yes.
Now, in world history, he's extolled. There is a famous encomium by H.G. Wells.
Yes.
Which is often cited. And of course, in Indian history, he is hailed as a great figure.
Yes.
Yeah? But in Hindu history, he is not given that honor which he receives in world history and Indian history.
Yes.
And that puzzled me. And it seems that the people who suffered at the hands of those invasions attributed it to the policies followed by Ashoka, which demilitarized the country.
Okay.
And with that cue, when I moved forward, I found that a number of features of the Manusmriti could be understood better.
But also, wasn't he, like, because he was also a Buddhist, so it's natural, I suppose, given the animosity, you know, between early Buddhists and now we call them Hindus, but perhaps at that point it's anachronism. But
follower of the Vedic religion.
Yes, the Vedic religion.
See, now, one has to, Manjula, one has to be very careful here. First of all, the idea that the Hindus and the Buddhists were antagonistic to each other around this period is based on a reference in the Mahabhashya of Patanjali, where he talks about eternal enemies. Like the snake and the mongoose.
Right? Okay.
But what scholars now have pointed out, that although many scholars have taken the relationship between the Shramana and the Brahmanas in the same spirit, this is a misreading, because Patanjali never refers to these people. This example of the hostility between Brahmanas and Shramanas is found in a 12th century text called Padmanjali. But somehow it got retrojected.
I see. Okay.
So we have to, first of all, revisit the whole issue of Hindu, we have to go back to Hindu-Buddhist rivalry. We have to reassess that. But it is very important, because my conclusion is that what upset the Hindus of the time, using the word anachronistically, was not Buddhism, but pacifism. Later on, we have another Buddhist dynasty called the Pala dynasty in Bengal.
Yes.
There is no diatribe against them, because they are Buddhists. So it was the pacifism, because the people blamed his pacifism for what they were suffering.
Okay.
Or rather, they blamed their suffering on his pacifism.
I see.
And there is a very telling line. I'd like to point to two very telling features. Actually, I might even say three. The first is that we have the Allahabad pillar inscription, right? And it has an inscription by Ashoka.
Yes.
The same pillar also has an inscription by Samudragupta, in which he boasts about his Digvijay, world conquest.
Yes.
As if to be saying, you Ashoka, you thought this is what royalty is? This is what kings do, or emperors do, what I have done. The second interesting cue is that the most popular epithet applied to Ashoka in the inscription is Devanampriya, the beloved of the gods.
Yes.
This expression means a fool in classical Sanskrit. That it is the way we might think of Pandit Nehru's policies towards China on the issue of Tibet. So these are three pieces of evidence, right?
Yeah.
I haven't shared with you the third one.
Yes.
The first one was Samudragupta inscribing the record of his martial victories on the same pillar on which we have Ashoka's inscriptions.
Yes.
The second, what was the second? I forgot it now.
He was called Devanampriya, and that's fool in Sanskrit.
Devanampriya, that was the second. And the third is, the food, right. And the third is that there's a text called the Gargi Sanhita. And the Gargi Sanhita has a line which is not applied to Ashoka, but which says, Sthapayishyati Mohatma Vijayam Nama Dharmikam. Only a fool will proclaim Dharma Vijay. So I was sharing with you the statement in the Gargi Sanhita.
Yes.
That only a fool will promulgate a victory by righteousness, called Dharma Vijay.
Okay.
So all this made me feel that the Ashokan experience has a very important implication for the understanding the manuscript.
Okay.
Yes, so this is one point.
Okay.
And that I try to highlight throughout the book.
Yes. Okay, and in your appendix also, you know, when you're looking at the nature of Hinduism and, you know, whether it's Brahminical, you know, and you point out various things. And what struck me particularly was how you said that, you know, if Hinduism was promulgated by Brahmins and was therefore Brahminical, so was Buddhism and Jainism, which we don't think of in those terms because they were also, you know, spread by Brahmins. Let's talk about that. That's something, you know, nobody thinks about.
Yeah. So there is a study by Uma Krivarti pointed out some years ago that for all the followers of the early Buddhism, that is the followers of the Buddha, of whom we could determine their background, about 40% of them were Brahmins.
Oh, okay.
And almost all the first generation major figures in Jainism, who are called Gurdharas, were Brahmins.
Oh, okay.
So this is a class, scholarly class, involved in the transmission of texts across the world.
Okay. So all the Indic religions, as it were, I mean, it was a result of this intellectual churn, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And perhaps we think of Buddhism and Jainism and, you know, Hinduism because they survived. There were others which didn't, I'm assuming.
They are, of course, distinct traditions.
Yeah.
But the idea that they are separate traditions is a kind of a modern invention. See, because the way the British looked at religions is in terms of exclusive identity.
Yes.
Because for them, the prototype of religion is their own religion, Christianity, or the Abrahamic religion, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And all these three religions, even though they believe in the same one God, presumably, regard themselves as different.
Yes.
Whereas in India, the concept of religious identity is more fluid and amorphous.
And another thing that struck me about this book was, you know, one doesn't, like, you've devoted a chapter to it about conversions to Hinduism. And, you know, one, like, as a Hindu, and, you know, however, whether one is, like, practicing or not, you think of Hinduism as one of those religions which doesn't, and only lately with the, you know, in the last early part of the 20th century and late 19th, that, you know, with the Arya Samaj and the Hindu Renaissance, you know, you think of conversion to Hinduism. You think of it as an alien concept to Hinduism, but you brought out how it isn't really so. So let's talk about that. I found that really fascinating.
No, I think that is an interesting point actually to pursue. And the key to that is what we just discussed. Because Hinduism allows for multiple religious identity. Right?
Yes.
So when somebody converts to Hinduism, quote unquote, he's not doing what conversion does in a Brahmic religion. That is, you have to give up your previous religion and then adopt the new religion. But there is no such process associated with following Hinduism. You can continue to be what you are and also start saying, I'm a Hindu. Because in Hinduism and in India in general, multiple religious, and that I think reflects the temper of the subcontinent prior to the, you know, the British intervention, especially through the census.
Okay. So, but, you know, also, you're talking about all this and, but the Manusmriti itself, you know, you deal with how Manusmriti, you know, talks about women. So let's talk about that because these are the contentious issues about the Manusmriti, right? The, what it says about women and what it says about, well, you know, what is now the Dalit section.
Yes,
so let's talk about that. Let's take women first.
Remind me about the Dalits. Let's take women first.
Okay.
So now, when we talk about the position of women in the Manusmriti, there is one verse which is quoted very often. People start with that verse.
Yes.
Pita rakshati kaumare, bharta rakshati yovane, putrastu sthavire bhave, nasti svatantya marhati.
Yes, right? Yes.
The father protects her when she is young. The husband, yeah?
Yes.
When she gets married in her youth. And the son in her old age.
Yes.
The last line says, a woman does not deserve to be swatantra.
Yes. True. Yeah.
And very shocking in a modern context, my God, she has no freedom.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
Now. Okay. So now there are two things to be kept in mind here.
Hmm.
First, the meaning of the word swatantra and its interpretation. Modern scholars have come to the conclusion that the word swatantra here means not that she is not free to do anything,
okay,
but that she cannot, as an independent legal agent, she cannot enter into legal transactions on her own.
Okay. Hmm. Which is of a piece with how women are treated anyway, everywhere, were treated. Yes.
Yeah. We should remember that till the 1960s, even in the USA, the wife could not open a bank account without the permission of the husband. This is what is meant by not being a legal agent, right?
Yeah.
So this is what it really means. But even here, one has to be careful.
Mm.
Because the woman always had the right to what is called istridhan.
Yes, that's true.
The money she has received from her parents, from relatives, things given to her as gifts. And she was quite an independent legal agent in dealing with that kind of wealth.
Mm.
And also, even there is an exception.
Mm. You point out that her wealth didn't go to the husband in case of death. It went to her children. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and the husband, you can help the husband, you know. And so, modern scholars have pointed out that the word swatantra there has a legal implication, not just a general one. She could not enter into a legal transaction on her own.
Okay.
This is true. Yeah. But here again, as we pointed out, she could deal with her stridhan independently. She could do whatever she wanted with it. She could bequeath it to her children, you know. So we have to understand it very carefully.
Okay.
But what's even more interesting is that the word swatantra, and some commentators have suggested this, can also mean something very different. Not to be left on one's own. Not to be left on one's own devices.
Meaning unprotected.
You see? Yeah. That is why there's an emphasis on protection. So she should not be left unprotected. Now, who is going to go against that? I mean, who is going to question that? So one has to understand these points carefully. It is true that she did not receive share of property the way sons might, right? All these are true. But then painting a picture as if she is totally bound down and chained, you know, to a certain lifestyle, it does not do justice to the verse.
Okay.
The other thing in relation to women, which I found very interesting and actually fascinating, was that when Manu speaks of a woman as a mother, as a sister, and as a daughter, his attitude is very different. So the role of the mother is extolled. In fact, sometimes it is almost embarrassing, you know, the way she is praised. The sister, especially the elder sister, is supposed to be treated like the mother.
Okay.
The daughter is said to be the object of supreme compassion. In fact, Manu even says that even if your daughter uses harsh words, you should not talk to her in kind.
Achha.
You know? Not say harsh things to her. So, and even with the wife, we know the famous verse where the women are worshipped, where they are respected, the gods dwell. And when they are not respected, all religious rites are futile. Yes.
Okay.
So it is true that in a certain the legal rights of the wife, and the daughter in a certain way are circumscribed. Yes. But then from that to paint a picture of her being virtually like a slave and having no independent identity, is misleading, in my view.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned other legal tracts as well that were written later. And you know, why is it that we are constantly thinking about only the Manusmriti?
Right,
you
yeah.
Know, expositions, so.
Now, the reason for that is historical. When British rule was established in India, then they had to administer justice to the subjects. And so they looked for a text for Hindu law on the basis of which they could administer that justice. And since this was the most respected of the Smritis, the Manu Smriti was placed before them by the people who consulted.
Okay.
And then, and again, the fact that they were Westerners becomes a factor. A lot of Hindu law is administered according to custom.
Yes.
Whereas the concept of law in the West is that what has been promulgated as law is implemented and enforced.
Yes.
As it is.
Yes. Yes.
So they also misjudge the role of the text.
Oh.
Again, because of their background.
Okay, so they brought their own sort of worldview and prejudices into this.
Yes, exactly. Consciously or unconsciously.
And the fact that they chose the Manusmriti is basically an historical, one of those historical accidents, because they could have chosen any other text, you know, right?
Yes.
Any other Smriti, perhaps.
For instance, Yajnavalk Smriti is very popular.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Narad Smriti is quite well known, yeah. But it so happened that the Manusmriti was projected as the one text, on which, on the basis of which they could administer Hindu law.
So it could very well have been that they formulated something based on the Bharat Smriti. If somebody had pushed, whoever they were in their talks with, had pushed that forward as the text, is that possible?
Yes. There's also another problem. When they consulted the Hindu pundits on any issue, like what should a wife do after the death of the husband, the pundits would give them the various options.
Okay.
According to the Smriti text. And they will zero in on one. And adopt that.
Oh, okay.
So there were several factors which created, we might call, a perfect storm.
Okay.
From a certain point of view, which led to the misinterpretation of,
So instead of having more open-ended sort of multiple choice thing, which is what, you know, Hinduism often allows, it became codified as this or that.
Exactly.
Okay. So, you know, let's talk a little bit also about, you know, I found it very interesting in the chapter on, you know, the Shudras and the treatment of the Shudras within the Manusmriti. You've also, you've shown that, yes, indeed, they you know, they were excluded in many ways, but also that
they were denied certain rights,
Yes, they were denied certain rights, but that also that the higher the caste is in case of, I found that very, you know, striking, is that the higher the caste is, the greater the punishment for transgressions, right?
So, yes, they were denied certain rights, that is true. But a very important point, people thought that their life had little value. This is totally false. Because one could tell a lie to save the life of a Shudra.
Okay.
This is totally inconsistent with the idea that little value was attached to their life.
Okay.
But I have tried to show how this impression was formed. Because this verse, because it allows you to tell a lie, was taken by Western scholars as encouraging perjury.
Okay.
And removed as further proof of the benighted state of the Hindus.
Okay. But tell me, you know, also you've shown that, you know, which struck me as sort of, you know, something that we don't think about, is that when we talk about the denial or the, you know, of rights to the Shudras, about how punishments were more severe the higher the up you went in the caste ladder. So let's talk about that. Yeah, so that part I found very
Yes,
interesting where
yeah.
you pointed out that, the same crime, say of theft, for a Shudra, for a Vaishya, for a Kshatriya, and for a Brahmin, invited greater punishments depending on the higher up you went. Isn't
Yes,
that what you
and
said?
what, yeah, and we were talking about women.
Yeah.
This also applies to a person who compromises a woman's rights. Same law, same rule.
Okay.
The higher the caste, the greater the punishment.
Oh, okay. So that has not been emphasized in our discussions of the Manusmriti, right? This
Yeah,
is an ignored part.
you see, people don't recognize that because the text says they will have the same punishment as that for a thief. They don't follow it up by realizing that the punishment for a thief varies with the caste, but in the opposite way of the usual,
Okay.
in a way opposite than the usual one. The higher the caste, the higher the punishment.
Okay.
So they don't follow through.
Yeah.
Yeah, when we talk about the Shudras, we should realize that the Manusmriti also talks of Shudra gurus, Shudra shishyas, Shudra kings, rich Shudras. He may not like this, but he admits to all this. The reason is that I think at that time, the Mlechhas, that is, those foreigners who had now been defeated and now were becoming Hindus, yeah, they will do it through becoming Shudras, right?
Oh,
Going
okay.
up the ladder, yeah.
Oh.
So it was a very ambiguous category, a beginning to
Oh.
become. Yeah, a tricky
Okay.
category.
Okay. So basically, it was a society in flux at that point, right?
Yes. And it is trying to shape the society in its vision. That is
Okay.
why I have compared it to the modern Indian constitution and the American constitution.
Yes, I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah. And that is, I think, the right perspective
Okay.
in which to see, yeah, in which to read the whole, what I think was going on in its broadest yeah, perspective.
Yes. So, also, like we referred to it in our earlier part of the conversation, this thing about conversions, and how you talk about, how Southeast Asia had the Hindu influence, right? How it came to have a strong Hindu influence. You want to talk about that? For a religion that supposedly does not encourage conversion. And you discuss that that sort of the difference, that challenge. How did they overcome the challenge, and how actually they did convert? So let's talk about that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, let's see that we have to be very careful. Hinduism does not seek converts. It accepts them. And when it accepts them, it does not ask them to really give up their previous lifestyle, except
Yes.
in some ways. Yeah. So you join the club, sort
But
of.
in the context of Southeast Asia and the movement of Brahmins and Vaishyas, traders there, an establishment of whatever Hinduism or those ways of belief over there. Now let's discuss that. How did that happen?
I try to make the point by distinguishing between a missionary religion and a proselytizing religion.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So Hinduism is a missionary religion. It has something to offer. And if you like it, okay, join the club. Yeah? Yeah.
Yeah.
Proselytizing religions deliberately seek converts.
Like Buddhism.
And when, yeah, but of course, Buddhism is different because Buddhism does not ask you to give up your previous allegiance if you become a Buddhist.
Yes, that's true.
But Christianity and Islam do.
Yeah.
So it's a proselytizing religion in a special way.
So it's an exception in that. But the Sangha did was more successful than the Hindu missionaries, you say, right?
Yeah. No. The Hindu missionaries, yeah, So you find, you know, in Japan, you find images of Ganesh in China.
You do, yeah.
You find shivlings in China.
Mm.
You find accounts of Brahmin colonies.
Yes.
In Chinese towns.
Mm.
So in that respect, it is less active as a missionary religion than Buddhism. Mm. Yeah. But
okay.
It is a missionary religion.
Okay.
It has a sense of mission. But you know, Manjula, the difference, the way communism tries to spread and the way democracy tries to spread. Now, the way communist countries try to spread communism and the way democratic countries try to spread democracy. Can you see the difference?
Yes, yes. So that's the analogy you're using. So, but in the end, I mean, like in modern India, of course, I don't know, we don't consider the Manusmriti, you know, I mean, like secular Indians, you know, we obviously we don't go to the ancient texts, we look to the constitution and, you know, all that. But the Manusmriti is still held up often, you know, as a text that kind of burdens us still. So what do you say to that, you know?
Yeah, I think I get the drift of what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
And my response to that would be that you see in the modern world, especially in India, we have two sources of value formation.
Mm.
We have our religions,
yes,
and cultural traditions.
Yes.
And we have modern Western liberalism.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both of these are part of our legacy.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. Now, if we want to achieve human flourishing, yeah,
mm,
or cultural flourishing in our own country,
mm,
then we should try to mobilize both of these.
Mm. Mm. But they're not at loggerheads in some instances.
Instead of seeing them in competition,
mm,
there is the modernity of tradition and there is the tradition of modernity.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
And if you look at it that way, you're able to bridge that difference. I mean, there is the constitution, but our daily life is governed so much by how we have been brought up. Yeah.
Yeah.
The family in which we have been born.
Yes.
Quote unquote, the caste to which we belong. So,
yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we should not abandon this source, right, as of no consequence, because it is a powerful force.
Yes, it is a powerful force. But do you think that, you know, like we are held back by, you know, of course, like we said, you know, it was a chance that they landed on the Manusmriti and gave it so much importance when there were other texts as well.
Yeah.
But the burden of that, even if it was caused in the colonial period.
It's a mixed blessing, but I would like to point out that modernity is a mixed blessing.
Mm.
Climate change,
yes,
ecological disaster,
yeah,
imperialism,
yes,
nuclear horror.
Mm.
This is also part of modernity.
Yes, that's also part of modernity. That's true.
So we have to apply our own judgment in the case of both.
Okay.
Tradition and modernity.
Mm. Mm. But what do you say to people who are, you know, who cling to orthodoxy and use things like the Manusmriti to enforce, you know, like say the caste system or secondary status for women, which is what is like the crux of this, right?
Yeah, but this is based on a misunderstanding. It is like saying that they will change the constitution and abolish abolish reservations.
Mm.
This is a canard.
Mm.
This is an untruth and has to be unmasked.
Mm.
As I point out in the book, the Manusmriti itself provides for the abolition of the so-called caste system.
Okay, let's talk about that. How does it do that?
There is a verse in the Manusmriti which says that anything, even if it has a Vedic source, which does not lead to well-being in the long run, and which is denounced by the people, should be given up.
Mm.
I'll try to quote the verse to you. I may not get it exactly because it's not in front of me.
Yes.
But parityajed artha kamau yau Syatam Dharma Varjitau. Give up that calm and earth which is opposed to dharma. Right?
Yes, yes.
Dharma Mapi. And even dharma. And elsewhere the text says, the root of which is the Veda. Two conditions. Asukho Darkam. In the long run, it does not lead to positive results. Lok Vikrusht. Denounced by the people.
Okay.
So if we denounce the caste system and we think it's not good for us, well, you are welcome to drop it. According to the Manusmriti. See, just as our own constitutions provide for amendment.
Yes.
You know, Manusmriti provide.
So it's not hard, set in stone, basically. It's not set in stone. That's what one should take from it. Like, it isn't a set of rules forever.
Oh, no. It always emphasizes well-being. Now, we may not agree with its concept of well-being, you know.
Yes. So, you know, what do you say to people who say that contemporary Hinduism is actually Brahmanism? Do you want to, you know, you've dealt with that, you know, on many points at the end. So, do you want to say something about that? Whether it is or it isn't?
Actually, Manjula ji, the fact is that modern Hinduism, as it is lived, present the Hinduism as it is lived in the villages, is tantric. It is not Brahmanical.
Okay. So talk about that. That's really interesting.
Yeah. So if you go to a village and all, you will find worship of deities.
Yes.
Which are not mentioned in the Manusmriti.
That's true. Yeah.
You will find their own customs.
Yes.
So you will have village deities, Kul Devta, Gram Devta.
Yeah.
And as it's a very interesting remark by a Western scholar by the name of Maine. Henry Maine, who wrote a book on Hindu ethics, I think. And he says that when he asked the people, how do you decide issues among themselves, issues of law? And they say, we discuss it among themselves and decide the matter. And if we are in doubt, we consult the pandit.
Okay.
This is real life Hinduism.
And so, you know, you also mentioned somewhere that, you know, it's actually not really Brahmanical, and the it is more the guru system, right? I think there's a mention somewhere here, and the gurus could be anybody. And also, you've also pointed out how people like Gandhi and Vivekanand were themselves not Brahmins, though they were the proponents of Hinduism, right? Of
yes, exactly.
So let's talk about that also. So if caste was indeed...
So calling Hinduism Brahmanical is like calling Christianity ministerial.
Huh.
Right?
Okay.
Huh. Ministers are spokespersons of the tradition.
Huh.
They perform certain rituals. It's like calling Islam Mullahism.
Okay.
And you can see how it distorts the whole thing.
Right. So you're saying that people who look at it only through the through this lens are sort of limiting themselves.
Yes. Now what has happened is that this has gained a certain measure of credibility, this kind of view, because it has been assiduously propagated for various reasons. Because of the way our academia has been influenced by Marxist thought because of the way in which our own perception of our tradition has been shaped by what Western scholars have said about it. So all these factors have contributed to Orientalism, as Sai points out. They have their own view of what Hinduism is.
So you're saying we've internalized that view.
And we have, yes. Yeah. We have to a certain extent, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
But just because something is prevalent or critical does not mean that it is correct.
Okay. You know, again, this brings me back to, you know, like, I mean, of course, Ambedkarites would disagree, and, you know, they'd say that, you know, that Brahmanism is what has kept us back, and indeed, yes. Like, you know, their circumstances have been they've been oppressed by the caste system. I mean, nobody can deny that. So,
No. But
so what would you say to, you know, that perspective?
Yes, I would say that Hinduism needs reform. Is accepted by all of us.
Yes, that's true.
The difference is whether you think that Hinduism itself has the resources to renew itself, or whether it is incapable of doing so and requires another religious system, today Christianity or Islam, or another ideology, Marxism.
Yes.
This is the issue on which we separate. So because Hinduism is a plural tradition, especially because it is a plural tradition, it offers you many options. And in every age, Hindus have their own, what would be the right word, their whole own menu.
Okay.
They change their order from the same menu.
So,
the menu has all the options.
Yes, yes. So when you look at this, then one can actually, when you look at it from this point of view, one can actually understand why Ambedkar chose Buddhism, right?
It's perfectly understandable because of his personal experience as an untouchable. Dr. Ambedkar came to the view that he could not see Hinduism offering him the kind of freedom, or dignity, which he wanted. And so he converted to Buddhism. But did all untouchables convert to Buddhism?
No.
No.
Yeah.
So there are a large number of untouchables who think that they can find their dignity within Hinduism. And some who think that they can't.
Yes.
And they are welcome to their choice, you know. But people don't realize that Dr. Ambedkar was not as hostile to the culture represented by Hinduism as we have been led to imagine. Many people don't know that he proposed that Sanskrit should be the official language of the Indian Union.
Wow, really?
Yeah, yes. You can look at the newspapers at the time in 1948, I think, when the Constituent Assembly was in session. It's very well documented.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's a very complex personality.
Of course, yeah.
And of course, he actually could talk in Sanskrit.
Oh. That, of course, because if he's interpreting
And
the...
again, people don't realize that he was totally opposed to the Aryan invasion theory. His whole book, Who Were the Shudras, is a refutation of this view.
Okay. Another thing I found very interesting in the book is that, you know, you mentioned how... the idea of reservations and the acceptance of it by large numbers of Indians who are not Shudras or were not, you know, from that section of society is connected to the idea of karma, you know, and reservations, the acceptance of.
Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned in the book that there's greater acceptance of reservations for the last 70 years in India than there is in the US. I didn't know that. So, you know. Okay.
Yeah, in the USA, they always ask, they always say, I don't own slaves.
I don't own slaves? But what is the connection? I mean...
when affirmative action for the blacks comes up, then the present generation says, I don't own slaves.
But their ancestors did. And...
Ah, but they say, then they ask for the ancestors.
Illogical.
This is the difference.
Okay. I see. So let's talk about the, you know, you've connected the idea of karma with the acceptance of this. So,
yes, this is a special case, accepting reservation and all, of a more general principle that you can't escape the consequences of your actions. Therefore, if your actions have been negative, have been evil, and have had negative consequences, then it is better to own up to that and do something to correct it. Correct the situation or make amends.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
this attitude, comes from an acceptance of the karmic worldview.
Okay.
Which means, we don't just live in a world, We live in a just world.
You also brought out this thing about how it turns out that not only are all human beings equal before karma and the manusmriti, all sentient creatures too would perhaps be considered equal before karma and the manusmriti, and even the gods may not be beyond the range of its operation. So do you want to talk about that?
Okay. So about the gods, sometimes people argue that because Ram killed Vali, concealing himself, Krishna got killed by a hunter who had concealed himself.
Yes.
So that even at that level, even at the level of the gods and their incarnations, you have confidence in karma.
Yes.
As an explanation of what's happening.
So the Manusmriti has also this. So we've been concentrating on perhaps parts of it which are antithetical to modern thinking, but there's also this. Yes. So do you want to talk about that?
Yes, yes. So there are elements in the Manusmriti which in that sense are very modern. Damaging a tree is punishable. See? So you have your ecological consideration. People don't realize that at the end of, I think, the second chapter of the Manusmriti, you have a series of verses which say, Shraddhana Shubham Vidyam Adhadit Avaradapi. The person of faith should accept learning even from an inferior person. Antyadapi Param Dharmam. Accept the highest teaching or knowledge from an untouchable. Isti Ratnam Dushkuladapi. A woman even from a bad family.
Yes, yes.
Vishadap Amritam Gahyam. Even out of poison, one should gather nectar. Baladapi Subhashitam. Even if a child says something meaningful or insightful, we have to accept it. Amitradapi Sadvrittam. Even from an enemy, one should even emulate an enemy in his good qualities. Gold may be collected even out of dust. And now the next verse is amazing. Istri Ratnan. Women, oho vidya, knowledge, isti ratnan oho vidya, dharmam, shocham, rules of purity, rules of normative conduct, subhashitam, good literature, you could broaden it out. All these should be accepted from everywhere.
Okay.
This is also Manu.
Okay. So this is a complex text with many many strands to it, right? And maybe perhaps we have been viewing it very narrowly and picking out only the negative bits within it.
That's right, yeah. The point I was trying to make was because Hinduism is a plural tradition. You have an exalted view of women. You have a demeaning view of women. It's all there in Hinduism.
Yes. Simultaneously, there are many strands.
Many strands. And so they will be reflected in the Manusmriti as a Hindu text.
Right. So meaning you can choose to be the kind of Hindu.
Exactly. So you see, you have to, this is the basic idea of karma.
Yes.
You have to make the choice and you alone will reap its results.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Okay. So what was the most difficult part about writing this book? Was there some bit where, you had to think very deeply?
It's a very good question. See, there is a lot in Manu which has to deal with jatis.
Yes.
And the marriage of castes and all that. And to a modern mind, it is not very appealing or appetizing.
Yeah, that's true.
So those sections of the Manu, even though, of course, one has to be very careful, because sometimes it says very interesting and useful things. For instance, if it's a question whether you can, how do you determine the varna of somebody if you don't know what it is?
Yeah.
By elections. But all this is lodged in a huge discussion of if A marries B, then what happens,
Yes.
Who do you call the offspring?
Yeah.
So all that, because people have made that controversial.
Yes. Yeah. And you also touched on the difference between Varna and Jati. So,
yes.
You know,
Manu is one of the early texts which starts talking about jati. And there is genetic evidence that the results of endogamy, marrying in the same group, are visible in the evidence from around the turn of the Christian era.
Yes.
Around the beginning of the Christian era, the time usually allotted to Manu. So Manu may have had an influence in that way.
Okay.
Encouraging people to marry among themselves, creating caste segregation.
So which is that can definitely be traced to this.
To Manu, which is a striking feature even of Indian life today.
Yes, it continues.
Yeah, it continues. Actually, it's astonishing. The Pew survey recorded that lower castes are more opposed to caste intermarriages than higher castes. Yeah, it's documented.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I really don't know. But this is a fact.
You're saying that the higher up in the system that you go, there are more intermarriages.
That is, if you ask your people who are Brahmins and Kshatriyas and, you know, Vaishyas and so on, what is your view? Would you oppose or support intermarriage across varnas or even jatis, actually? The proportion of people who are opposed to this is higher in the lower varnas, thus jatis.
But that could also be a result of, I don't know, maybe not enough exposure to other ways of thinking or to liberalism.
Could be that the higher caste tend to be better educated. Yeah. And that's a good point. Very good point. Yeah. And then you move away from it as you get better educated.
Yes.
It was a surprising finding. The other interesting finding of the Pew report was that 85% of the people surveyed said that they have not experienced any discrimination based on caste for the past year.
Oh, really?
5%.
Okay. That's quite reassuring. Because, I mean, we have this idea that we are so caste-bound.
That it is rampant.
That it's rampant.
Caste segregation is rampant. Not necessarily caste discrimination.
Though perhaps in educational institutions, you know, often people say there is, you know, microaggressions and stuff.
But you see, Manjulaj, is a very important point. Often, what is seen as caste discrimination is linguistic discrimination.
How so?
In the sense that the lower castes have less access to English than the higher castes.
Okay.
So it is camouflaged as caste.
But that's also a systemic problem now, because lack of exposure.
Look at the number of people who drop out after being admitted to IITs and IIMs.
Yes.
On the basis of reservation.
Yeah. But again, that's because they don't have access to the educational tools to make...
Is the English medium obstacle?
Yes, the English medium obstacle.
It is not just their caste. You might say that because they are lower caste, they have less facilities and all.
Yes.
But intrinsically, it is a linguistic discrimination, not caste discrimination.
Yes. Though we can argue about the access.
And if caste is a secondary way, you might say. But essentially, it is linguistic.
Okay. So, you know, sir, I mean, that's why I found your book really interesting, because it touches on all these things and, you know, it gives a broader perspective on the Manusmriti that one doesn't know about. You know, one just tends to think of it as, you know, you just like the women are chattel, that sort of, and, you know, like, so, but the broader thing you've brought out, like the broader things about how, you know, discrimination within the patriarchal setup of the time and where it, the context of Manusmriti, all that. So, and how it can't be, I mean, it isn't a text that's for all time also.
Manusmriti itself is aware of it. Actually, at least 46 Smritis are known to have existed.
Okay.
They either exist or have been referred to in the literature.
Yes.
No less than 46.
So
I hope my figure is right, but it's around in that area.
Okay. So it's like you said, it's just a historical chance that we happen to be fixated on this one.
Settle on it. The point then is that the smritis were a way of updating your legislation, as it were, with changing times, modifying, correcting, updating. That is why there are so many.
Okay. And even like our view of the past as being static. So from the 2nd century to the 8th century, there's such a big gap. So there must have been such a big difference in the social conditions in the 2nd century and in the 8th.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Quite a bit.
So so it wasn't set in stone, basically. I mean, what was...
Not at all. Yeah. And there's an awareness within the tradition of this.
Okay.
Yeah. You see, the word Sanatan can be very misleading.
Okay.
It need not always mean eternal.
Yes.
It can always mean immemorial.
Oh, okay.
So it's a tradition whose origins are lost in the mists of antiquity, right?
Yeah.
It's a continuous tradition, elements of both change and continuity.
So it's not a static thing. So we can't think that, you know, Manusmriti was written then and we should follow the same thing. Like a lot of people seem to be thinking, you know, a lot of people think like that also. Yeah. So, you know, your book made me think about all this. You know, one tends to reject a whole way of thinking without knowing the context of it. Whereas your book gives the context. So I found that very interesting.
Well, thank you very much. That was partly the reason why I wrote it. And it's very gratifying to know that people are liking it for precisely that.
Okay.
It's very rare. It's very rare for an author to find that people like the book for the reason he wrote it.
On that note, we'll end. For the listeners, go out and get From Fire to Light, Rereading the Manusmriti by Arvind Sharma. It is very instructive and it's very interesting, and it'll also banish many of our preconceived notions that we have. So thank you, sir, for talking to me.
Thank you. All the best.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
To stay updated on this podcast, follow us at HD Smartcast on all the major social media platforms. To listen to more such podcasts, log on to www.hdsmartcast.com.
Some things are college freshman essentials, like shower sandals, because otherwise, yuck. And of course, a Brita pitcher. Your teen could save over $240 a year by switching to Brita from bottled water. Plus, Brita Elite removes 99% of lead from tap water. Get your freshman a Brita pitcher with the Elite filter today. 99% of lead certified by WQA. Substances reduced may not be in all users' water. $240 savings a year versus standard 16.9 fluid ounce water bottles. Savings assumes pre-purchase of Brita system.